Good evening. Trump gets another shot at winning. The joy is not joyful in front of Congress. And more on Steve Bannon's China obsession. With these and other stories, I'm Paul DiRienzo with the WBAI News for Tuesday, August 25th, 2020. Jacob Blake, the black man shot multiple times by police in Wisconsin, is paralyzed, and it would take a miracle for him to walk again, his family attorney said Tuesday, while calling for the officer who opened fire to be arrested and others involved to lose their job. The shooting of Blake on Sunday in Kenosha, apparently in the back while three of his children looked on, was captured on cell phone video and ignited new protests over racial injustice. We'll be having more on that story later in the broadcast. Yesterday, President Donald Trump was renominated for a second term at the Republican National Convention, a mostly online affair with some live at the Charlotte Convention Center in Charlotte, North Carolina, and the Andrew W. Mellon Auditorium in Washington, D.C. In one of several acceptance speeches planned for Trump, he made a digression to talk about his work to bring down drug prices in the United States, home of the world's highest drug prices.
Big Pharma, they call it, for a reason. There's nobody that gives the politicians more money than Big Pharma. Yeah. Nobody, not even close. So I said, well, look, if you're not going to negotiate a fair deal, we're going to do a favored nations clause to the top people, the biggest guys. They said, no, don't do that favored nations stuff. Favored nations, because, you know, we have countries out there that are paying a tiny fraction of what our people are expected to pay. So if you have a country, Germany or others, they make, by the way, UK, all of Europe, Canada pays 50%, 50% less. In fact, people leave our country, go to Canada, pick up their drugs, and they come back home. Can you believe it? This is the kind of difference. So I say, no, I want a favored nations clause. I also want a rebate clause, a rebate where instead of the money going to the middleman, who have to be the richest people in the world, they get so much. They get more money, frankly, than the drug companies. At least the drug companies make a product. So I wiped out the rebate where now it goes to people. And I instituted what's called a favored nations clause. And it's very simple. You have that in deals. It's whatever the lowest price in the world. We're the biggest purchaser of prescription drugs by far in the world. So whatever the lowest price is that other countries pay. So if you have a country paying 10 cents for a pill and we're paying $2.50, and it's not such an exaggeration, believe me, then we get it for 10. So what happens is that doesn't work. So they'll go up a little bit. We'll come way, way down. So I said, favored nations, I want to pay what the lowest price is anywhere in the world. We're the biggest purchaser. We want a favored nations. They had a heart attack. And then I signed it. They didn't believe it. And now what they're doing is they have ads, millions and millions of dollars worth of ads that I've been horrible to the people because of drugs. And I believe in socialism. Socialism. You know why? Because some of the socialistic countries get the lowest price. So the only thing I have with socialism is I want to get their price. OK, that's the only thing. Other than that is our country will never be a socialist country. Okay?
President Donald Trump yesterday at the Republican National Convention. Among the speakers last night, United Nations Ambassador Nikki Haley, Donald Trump Jr., and the only black GOP senator, Tim Scott. Tonight, Kentucky Senator Rand Paul is joining Secretary of State Mike Pompeo, who's broadcasting live in Jerusalem while on State Department work in the Middle East, and First Lady Melania Trump from her remake of Jackie Kennedy Onassis's White House Garden. Trump will probably speak again as well. Meanwhile, this weekend's unprecedented House hearing into the activities of Postmaster General Louis DeJoy and reports of problems that might hamper mail-in voting this November continued on Washington, on Capitol Hill. Representative Jim Cooper, Democrat from Tennessee, went so far as to almost accuse DeJoy of corruption.
Mr. DeJoy, here's what your so-called reforms have done to my district in 70 days. A lady named Elena Roser.
Congressman Cooper.
Mr. DeJoy, here's what your so-called reforms have done to my district in 70 days. A lady named Elena Roser paid $5 on July 22nd to send a certified letter to the Nashville, Tennessee Social Security office. The distance is 20 miles. The letter took 12 days to arrive. Just this morning, excellent reporting from Nashville's Channel 5 TV proves that Nashville's mail trucks are being forced to leave on schedule even when completely empty. Imagine it, 53-foot trucks forced to travel hundreds of miles completely empty due to your so-called reforms. Here are the truck records. That's not efficiency. That's insanity. For anyone thinking of voting absentee, the effect of your policies is to unilaterally move up Election Day from November 3rd to something like October 27th. And if you force more empty trucks on the highway, you will be able to single-handedly move up Election Day even earlier. According to NPR, already 550,000 primary ballots, absentee ballots, were rejected in just 30 states. And one of the main reasons was late delivery. How dare you disenfranchise so many voters when you told the Senate committee just last week that you had a sacred duty to protect election mail? You know that it's a felony for a Postal Service officer or employee to delay delivery of mail. A postal employee can be fined or imprisoned for up to 5 years for delaying the mail, but somehow you can delay all the mail and get away with it. They can be prosecuted, but you can't, even if your actions are a million times worse. Mr. DeJoy, do you have a duty to obey U.S. law like every other American?
I do, sir.
Well, previous Postmasters General have been punished for much smaller conflicts of interest than yours. In 1997, the 70th Postmaster General, Marvin Runyon from Tennessee, had to pay $27,000 because of a $350,000 conflict of interest. If your $30 million conflict of interest, 100 times larger than Mr. Runyon's, were treated like your predecessors, you would have to pay a $2.7 million fine and probably be ousted from being Postmaster General. So, Mr. DeJoy, are you above the law that applies to other Postmasters General?
I don't agree with the premise. I'm in full compliance with all ethical requirements that I need to have. And there's an OIG investigation, and I welcome the result of that report.
Well, Mr. DeJoy, as a mega donor for the Trump campaign, you were picked along with Michael Cohen and Elliot Broidy, two men who have already pled guilty to felonies, to be the three deputy finance chairmen of the Republican National Committee. Did you pay back several of your top executives for contributing to Trump's campaign by bonusing or rewarding them?
That's an outrageous claim, sir, and I resent it.
I'm just asking a question.
The answer is no.
So you did not bonus or reward any of your executives?
No.
Or anyone that you solicited for a contribution to the Trump campaign?
No, sir.
Not in whole or in part?
During the Trump campaign, I wasn't even working at my company anymore.
Well, we want to make sure that campaign contributions are legal. So all your campaign
I'm fully aware of legal campaign contributions.
Well, what if
I resent the assertion, sir? What are you accusing me of?
Well, I'm asking a question. Do your mail delays fit Trump's campaign goal of hurting the post office, as stated in his tweets? Are your mail delays implicit campaign contributions?
These types of questions. I'm here to represent the Postal Service. It has nothing to do with all my actions have to do with improvement into the Postal Service. Am I the only one in this room that understands that we have a $10 billion a year loss? Right? Am I the only one in this room
will
that
you
has
give
looked
this
at the OIG reports
Will you
that
give
have
this
up?
Committee your communications with Mark Meadows, with Treasury Secretary Mnuchin,
Go
with the President?
Go ahead and do that.
Mr. DeJoy, is your backup plan to be pardoned like Roger Stone?
Oh, God. Pitiful.
You have 2 seconds to answer the question.
I have no comment on that. It's not
I
worth
see my time has expired.
Gentlemen, not time worth has comment. Expired. Representative, the gentleman from Florida, Mr.
Representative Jim Cooper, Democrat of Tennessee, he was having an interesting time questioning Louis DeJoy, the Postmaster General. And New York Representative Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez also has some questions for DeJoy.
DeJoy, for coming in and offering your testimony today. Mr. DeJoy, when your announcement in your new position as Postmaster General was announced, you know, there was some folks that were flagging concerns that you would be the first Postmaster General in two decades without previous experience or service directly in the USPS. But to be fair, and as you mentioned, you do have extensive career experience in supply chain logistics, correct?
I do.
And in fact, you served as CEO of your own supply chain company, New Breed Logistics, for 30 years, correct?
I did.
And that was up until about 2014 when you merged New Breed Logistics with another company, XPO Logistics, where you also served as CEO for a year and then served on its board of directors until about 2018 when you submitted your resignation, correct? Now, I would like, Madam Chairwoman, I would like to submit to the committee three documents for the record. The Postmaster's new entrant report detailing his financial disclosures, publicly available data detailing the USPS top suppliers for the last 3 years, and the recent XPO SEC filings. Now, Mr. DeJoy, you've received... Thank you. Mr. DeJoy, you've received about $1.86 million in rental payments from your former company, XPO, correct?
Approximately, yes.
Have you taken any meetings with XPO Logistics since becoming Postmaster General?
I have not.
Have you emailed, texted, called, video conferenced, or communicated with your former company, XPO Logistics?
I have many friends at the company, and I've spoken to them casually over the last several months. Yes, I probably would have spoken to him.
Thank you. Now, you started in your role as Postmaster General on June 16th of this year. That's a very big job. Don't need to tell you that. And it has a lot of responsibility. You mentioned meeting with President Trump, Secretary Mnuchin. I can't even imagine how busy that must be. Now, do you keep a daily calendar?
I do, yeah.
Have you or your staff made any deletions to your calendar since becoming Postmaster General on June 16?
I don't think so.
You don't think so? Mm-hmm. Do ethics officers at USPS have access to your calendar to screen conflicts of interest?
We have an ethics officer that looks at meetings that I have, yes.
And they have full access to your calendar?
They will work, yes.
Can we get a commitment from you to submit your calendar dating back to June 16th to this committee?
I don't know. I'll check with counsel.
I
want to set a precedent for my calendar to be submitted every 2 months.
Well, according to regulations that we currently have, electronic calendars that are submitted and maintained on USPS computers are agency records. And so can we get your commitment to hand that calendar over to this committee as a matter of course for investigation?
I'm new to this. If that is, in fact, a process that our counsel says I must comply with, then I will do that, yes.
Thank you. Madam Chairwoman, I would say, you know, the details of this calendar are extraordinarily important to the committee's investigations, and if we cannot receive them voluntarily, I would recommend consideration of a subpoena for these details. Now, lastly, and selfishly, I represent New York's 14th Congressional District. We have written the agency several times regarding accessibility for a ramp in our historic Jackson Heights post office.
All right. And that was Representative Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez doing some of the politics that makes politics interesting, local politics. Meanwhile, another American city is struggling with anger over the shooting of a black man. Jacob Blake, an unarmed father, apparently shot in the back. Reportedly, 7 shots were fired. For the past 2 nights, protesters in Kenosha, Wisconsin have been met with riot cops, tear gas, and stun grenades. And Wisconsin Lieutenant Governor Mandela Barnes had this comment.
And let me be clear, this was not an accident. This wasn't bad police work. This felt like some sort of vendetta being taken out on a member of our community. The officer's deadly actions attempted to take a person's life in broad daylight.
All right, and that was Lieutenant Governor of Wisconsin, Mandela Barnes. Barnes's fiancée is Lakeisha Booker.
They didn't even know the kids was in the car. And I'm telling the woman cop, I'm like, can you please get back before I shoot you? Get back. Like, these officers is handling, I'm like, shoot me. My kids is in the car. We're just shooting them with the kids in the back screaming. That don't make no sense that you treat somebody like that. Who unarmed, not giving you no problem. He ain't throwing no punch or nothing.
And that's Barnes's fiancée, Lakeisha Booker. At a news conference, community leaders made plain the problem was the police, and such a confrontation wasn't unexpected in the black community.
Asking for the arrest and prosecution of the two officers who shot an unarmed man with two children in the car.
We, as in black people, are tired of the police always attacking us.
Before Jacob was gunned down, he was breaking up an altercation that he had nothing to do with. But in the eyes of a racist killer cop, that is not what they saw. Jacob's black skin.
Community leaders who made plain the problems facing the African-American community in Kenosha, Wisconsin. Basketball great LeBron James, currently reading the autobiography of Malcolm X, also spoke out.
We see the guns fire, and his family is there, the kids are there, it's in broad daylight, and it's this through the grace of God that he's still living. Seven shots, close range, and he's still alive. That's through the grace of God right there, and my prayers goes out to that family and that community, but I got nothing nice to say about those cops at all. We are scared as black people in America.
Basketball great LeBron James. Protests continue across the United States. Last night, 1,000 marched from Washington Square Park across the Brooklyn Bridge calling for justice. And you're listening to the news on WBAI New York. I'm Paul D'Arienzo. Reportedly, more than 40% of the 175,000 COVID-19 deaths reported in the United States have been linked to nursing homes. The senior researcher for Americans for Financial Reform is Richard Woodall.
Nursing homes have largely been invisible to the American public, and that kind of long-standing chronic understaffing and underinvestment and lack of oversight on the federal and state level created sort of a recipe for disaster. Nursing home residents are extremely vulnerable to infections like this. But what we found is that, and this has been known for a long time, is that the kind of Wall Street investment in nursing homes lowers quality, reduces staffing rates, and has kind of worse medical outcomes. So what we found was that in New Jersey, that the nursing homes that were affiliated with these Wall Street private equity firms had much higher infection rates, considerably higher fatality rates than other nursing homes in the state.
How did Wall Street financial industry gamblers get involved in something as basic and vital as nursing home care?
This has been going on for a while. Hundreds and hundreds of nursing homes were bought up by private equity firms going back to 2000 or so, and the three biggest chains were owned by private equity for a while. Their rationale is kind of simple. One is that there are steady, if not amazing, revenues. And the second is that there's a ton of real estate that they can loot. So these nursing homes sit on land that they own, and many private equity firms basically bought up nursing home chains and siphoned away the real estate assets into a separate subsidiary. And then what they did was load up the nursing home chains with debt in a leveraged buyout, force them to pay rent on facilities they previously owned, and then cut corners, mainly by reducing staff. And that generated tons of profits for Wall Street. But what it did was made it very difficult for the nursing homes to be financially stable enough, even under ordinary times, to cope with providing adequate care for residents. During the crisis of a pandemic, I think they were uniquely unsuited to provide the care necessary to prevent this destructive virus from really.
How do other countries do this? How do other societies do this? And have we learned anything from what happened here?
Many other countries have a national health system that provides care for more people, more universal, more comprehensive, and with less profit incentives in it. In the United States, obviously, we have a lot of major for-profit operators. The unique thing, there are kind of unique problems with private equity that have perverse incentives to extract more value, more profits, more assets from these healthcare institutions. And what that ends up doing is enriching Wall Street, but at the cost, every penny that's taken out to pad the pockets of Wall Street titans actually comes out of providing care to patients and family members.
I've heard the governor and the mayor and the president speak on this, and they're always passing the buck off to the other person. So what could be done to change this? Is there anything that's out there?
We need to get private equity out of healthcare altogether. And really, it's a situation where, you know, the private equity is behind the surprise medical billing phenomenon. They have kind of destroyed bunches of ambulance systems across the country. They are the force that a safety net hospital to serve predominantly Black and brown community of North Philadelphia, and it's now gone. It's off the table for this pandemic.
So are you saying that we need a sort of a Bernie Sanders type of single-payer health system? That's the only real answer to this?
I personally think that a Medicare for all system would obviously provide more people with more coverage for more things, and that would obviously be of great benefit. It also would invest in kind of more public health investments. And right now, during the pandemic, it's obvious that we have substantially underinvested in public health assets and resources and talent at a time when we desperately need it. Private equity is an area where the kind of corrosive and predatory behavior of these Wall Street players is well known, right? This is the kind of situation that turned Toys R Us inside out and laid off tens of thousands of workers and been behind a number of kind of high-profile layoff problems and looting of companies. But in the healthcare sector, when they do this, what they're doing is extracting money that could have been used to provide needed healthcare to people. And that is really sort of unconscionable, and it's really time to put an end to that.
Patrick Woodall is senior researcher for Americans for Financial Reform. And finally, as Steve Bannon walked free on bail from the federal court in Manhattan this week, questions swirl over his private wall building project and his relationship with a Chinese exile living the life of luxury in Manhattan. The exile, Guo Wenhui, also known by 11 aliases, wanted for corruption and rape in China, is said to be Bannon's main muse on Chinese politics. It was Guo's $30 million yacht where Bannon was busted earlier this week near the Connecticut shore. It turns out that Michael Peck is a friend of Bannon and of Guo, and Michael Peck was recently named by Trump to head the government organization that oversees the Voice of America, where he instituted a massive purge of people in the areas of the of Voice of America that deal with the Middle East, Radio Free Europe, Radio Free Asia, and especially the Open Technology Fund, which finances things like software of an open source nature that would be free and not be owned by any one private entity. This organization was totally defunded and its board removed. Mallory Nodal is the chief technologist at the Center for Democracy and Technology, which is a group that filed a brief and sort of a lawsuit to restore the cuts to the fund. And she had this to say.
The Open Technology Fund is there to fund technology projects. So I think of it as kind of like a venture capitalist or an investment fund, even though it has none of those sort of investment qualities, but coming from government funding. So recognizing that the government ought to invest in and pay attention to the technology that underlies the internet as a way of preserving freedom and democracy, both in the United States, but all over the world. And it's been a very effective strategy for 10 plus years. And so it's disappointing to see it being dismantled in this way, because we really do need tools and secure internet protocols that we know work and that protect users' privacy, and especially for activists, journalists, and so on in repressive regimes around the world.
How did China get into this?
There was just a recognition that in order to reach citizens in China to get around the Great Chinese Firewall, that there would have to be interventions at a technical level to do so. And that has expanded from there, because China is not the only government that uses technology for authoritarian ends. It's gone from simply censorship to all kinds of digital use of spying technology. It's very wide-reaching, and it's not just China. It's actually many, many countries around the world, including the United States to some degree, that uses the internet to spy on dissenters.
You mentioned Chinese firewall. Just briefly, what is that?
China's internet is not connected to the rest of the internet in the way that we think about it. So there's a lot of filtering of what comes in and out of China, and there's a lot of monitoring then. So China uses really expensive ways of surveying what goes across its networks. China has controlled its internet to a degree that no other country can. I think that the closest country behind it in terms of its ability to control all of the ingress and egress networks would be maybe Russia or Iran. And they have total control of what comes in and out, and also then, of course, what happens inside the network in China.
You would think that the president would want to have a strong position to get news into China from the United States.
Previously, the United States and a bunch of its democratic allies held the opposite pull from China, which is that we want a free and open internet where users are at the center, and they're, you know, we're able to have democracy because the internet is complete and ubiquitous and it's unfettered, etc. The U.S.'s approach now is very much, we want to control the internet. We want to control the market around internet implementation and operation, which we saw with the Bureau of Commerce rule around Huawei deals, which was a while back, and things have changed even since then. So now there's a lot of questions around realizing that maybe the internet isn't totally a benign set of tubes, right? It's actually quite a political thing that needs a lot of careful governance, that in fact the United States would like to continue dominating that governance. And it sort of has still polarity with China, but in a different way.
The U.S. is doing this because ultimately down the line they want to sort of put an end to all this open source stuff and make everything proprietary, you have to pay for, and it'd be American companies controlling it.
I definitely think that that is a risk. And it sounds like, yeah, they're just pushing for maybe their cronies or other people who have similar projects but that are proprietary. And I think that that's a really poor reason to sort of ditch this more grand ideology about a free and open internet just because, you know, you want to give contracts to people you know better.
Since this came off of my interest in what happened on the border wall scam that they arrested Mr. Bannon for, here's another Trump-linked grift, basically, that seems to be to enrich his supporters and friends.
Yeah, it's a real pity. We really need Open Technology Fund around, and we need it to be funding these critical tech projects, everything from applications that regular users would have on their phones to hidden but cornerstone technology that is fundamental to the way that the internet functions for privacy and security of all users.
And that's Molly Nodal. She's a chief technologist at the Center for Democracy and Technology. And that's some of the news for Tuesday, August 25th, 2020. The news is produced with Linda Perry. Our engineer is Reggie Johnson. From New York City, I'm Paul DiRienzo for the WBAI Evening News. Thanks for joining us.